Meet Daniel Kish. He's a man of many, many talents.
I like to hike. I like to spend time in nature. Listen to music. To do music. To write. To read. I like to spend time with kids. I'm vegan. I am a trained vocalist. I like experiencing different cultures. I have friends in every country.
Oh, and one more thing. Daniel likes to bike. He's leading me on a bike ride as we speak here in Culver City in Los Angeles. And I've ridden with a lot of people before, but I have never biked alongside a person who is completely blind. And how does Daniel Kish do it? Well, with those clicks.
The method is called echolocation. Daniel calls it flash sonar. And he's helping to teach it to other blind folks through his foundation. It's called World Access for the Blind. And here's how echolocation works.
It's the same process that bats use, and it is literally a process of seeing with sound. So bats emit flashes of sound, and those flashes go out as flashes of light would, and they return to the listener. And humans can do the same sort of thing by emitting flashes of sound and receive enough reflection of sound to be able to construct images based on the pattern of those reflections.
Can you sort of, you mean a demonstration of it?
Well, a very simple demonstration is just simply getting clearly audible echo reflections from the immediate environment. So if I click, your microphones are going to pick up an echo from this building to my right. And that's the most predominant feature in this area. So when I walk into a new area, the first thing I do is I take stock of the most prominent features. So in this particular area, the three most prominent features would be that building, the umbrella in the middle of this table, and the tree behind me, and the canopy that covers this area. Okay. Now further away to our left, there's another building that's slightly further away.
That's the NPR.
That would be the
NPR West building.
Yeah, that'd be the NPR West building. And this building has a much more defined reflection than this building, which suggests that A, the building must be at some sort of angle relative to us.
And it is.
And B, that it must have more texture to it. Pillars, alcoves, I don't know, maybe balcony structures.
It has a very high cavernous ceiling indeed.
Right. So those are the kinds of patterns that catch my attention, and those are the kinds of patterns of reflections that give richness to the images that are possible from sonar.
How did you start with the clicks? You were a kid?
Yeah, I've been clicking for as long as I can remember. So I think that children are incredibly adaptable.
And intuitive.
And we know this. And I work a lot with children, especially very young children. And what I often tell parents when children lose their sight is warn and support parents to try and get themselves out of the way of the adaptation process and become more an asset to it than a liability, because children will adapt if given support to do so and given space to do so.
When you say support and space, is it that a lot of kids who are blind may at a young age start clicking but will be discouraged from doing it?
Well, the clicking is part of it. It's the overall process of being willing to reach out into the environment and discover what is around them. And if that discovery process is broken by introducing a situation that is not natural, such as keeping the blind child in a playpen or a crib or in the corner, or such as always guiding their hands around their environment or guiding their bodies around their environment.
You just have to let them figure it out.
You really do. You really do.
You just have to let them figure it out. If they get hurt, that's part of it.
Well, that is a big part of it, and that's a part of any child learning.
I mean, as a parent, obviously I don't have a blind child, but your instinct as a parent is for a kid not to get hurt, which is tough.
Yes, it is tough. But there's still a kind of an a priori difference. When a sighted child gets hurt, we consider it to be unfortunate. When a blind child gets hurt, we consider it to be tragic.
And you're saying that it should be considered to be inevitable.
Inevitable and part of growing up. And we really need to kind of divest ourselves of that double standard.
I'm speaking with Daniel Kish. He's the founder of World Access for the Blind. It's a group that helps blind people live independent lives.
You decided, I guess about 10 years ago, that you wanted to help other blind folks live independently. You created a nonprofit. It's called World Access for the Blind. Can you tell me about what you do?
Our main focus is supporting individuals to access their environment better.
And this is not just about echolocation or flash sonar. It's not just about teaching clicks or spatial awareness. This is about a philosophy.
It is about a philosophy that we call no limits philosophy, which challenges us to challenge what we think we know, to challenge every boundary, every box, every limitation that we've either put up ourselves or allowed ourselves to be conditioned to accept.
In other words, most people would say, well, blind people shouldn't probably go too far out on their own, or, you know, there are limitations. There are things that they shouldn't be doing. You're saying that's actually false. It's a false choice.
It's a false premise. It is a premise of what I call conventional wisdom. Conventional wisdom doesn't favor blindness. Conventional wisdom basically favors the perpetuation of convention. And blindness is not conventional. It's anything and everything but conventional. So we tend to challenge conventional wisdom to expand itself and accept that there are situations and circumstances which are not conventional, yet which still warrant accommodation, consideration, acceptance, awareness. For example, one boy had lost his vision from an asthma attack, and they wouldn't provide him orientation and mobility.
It's essentially somebody who could teach him how to get around.
Yes, orientation and mobility, someone who could teach him how to get around. He was in a wheelchair because he'd lost the use of his legs in the brain attack, and also his vision. But because he had someone pushing him around in a wheelchair, it was seen that there was no need for orientation and mobility. Well, this went on for 3.5 years before I got hold of him. And I reviewed his situation, and I was able to mobilize other approaches to helping him move around. In this case, we were using a hiking stick. So we had him with a hiking stick in one hand and a long cane in the other. We also taught him flash sonar, and we taught him to use the little slivers of vision he had more efficiently. And within a year, he had left his wheelchair behind.
Hey Daniel, I read quotes from folks who work for National Organizations for the Blind. They aren't comfortable with you and with what you say you can teach blind people. Why do you think that is?
We have supporters and we have opponents. Anytime you have an established convention, the one who comes along and says that it can be done differently, it can be done better, it can be done faster, that person is seen as the renegade. And we are, I think, seen as renegades in many instances. We really want to bring the power of action back into the hands of the consumer, of blind individuals and of their families. Right now, it has been usurped by professionals and by others, in my opinion, and it's not going anywhere. So families and consumers, blind consumers themselves, need to step up to the plate and say, okay, well, this is what we want. This is how we get it.
That's Daniel Kish. He's the founder of World Access for the Blind. You can find out more about the organization and Daniel at our website, npr.org. Daniel Kish, thank you.
Thank you.